From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jessica Yellen in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. A new report out from the World Health Organization has a stark warning about antibiotic resistance. Deadly superbugs are now everywhere, and we're in severe danger of heading into an era in which antibiotics don't work anymore, an era in which common infections kill. Can this be avoided? What has to happen? This hour on Point, a big wake-up call about antibiotics and how we move forward. You can join us on air or online. Does antibiotic resistance have you worried? How do you respond to this threat? And could it change how you interact with your doctor, whether or not you ask for a course of antibiotics? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Atlanta, Georgia, is Maren McKenna, a journalist and author. Maren follows the subject closely at Wired's Superbug blog. She's also author of the book Superbug, The Fatal Menace of MRSA. She's working on a new book about antibiotics and agriculture. We'll talk MRSA, antibiotics, agriculture, all of it with Maren McKenna. Thank you for joining us on Point.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start, Maren, with this new report from the World Health Organization, which essentially threatens that we're on the brink of a post-antibiotic era in which the drugs we rely on no longer work for minor infections. This sounds terrifying. Would you help us understand what is the news in this report?
Sure. So this report, which came out at the end of last week, is significant for several different reasons. The first is it's the first global look at antibiotic resistance. Now, in the past, there have been reports from different national governments. In fact, just a year ago, within about 7 days of each other, there were national reports from both the US CDC and its equivalent in England, and both of those said antibiotic resistance is very dire, but they were talking just about country statistics. This is global statistics. So of the 190-some countries that make up the World Health Organization's governing body, 114 of them sent in data that collectively said major classes of antibiotics of bacteria are not responding any longer to major classes of antibiotics in really significant ways, really high percentages. So what that means is antibiotic resistance is a significant problem worldwide, and we're running out of drugs to treat those bacteria worldwide.
So that's upsetting. Let's just back up for a minute and try to figure out how we got here. We think of antibiotics as a discovery that helped revolutionize our world and, you know, advance our civilization. What has happened?
So you're right. Antibiotics did really change the world. And it's for those of us who've grown up within the antibiotic era, which started really in about the 1940s, it's hard for us to imagine a time when antibiotics didn't work. But in the time of our grandparents or great-grandparents, really common infections killed people. You know, you could scratch yourself, you could cut yourself, you could get injured at work, you could develop an infection when you were giving birth. And those were potentially deadly and often were deadly. Antibiotics changed all that. Now, antibiotic resistance is a natural process. It's what bacteria do to defend themselves against each other, against the compounds that bacteria, other bacteria make to kill bacteria near them, to clear out living space for their descendants, to compete for resources such as food. What we did when we put antibiotics out into the world was to accelerate that process, so that we put what's called selective pressure on bacteria by applying antibiotics to them, and they evolve to get away from that, to survive. That was okay for a while, because for as long as bacteria developed that resistance, we always had new drugs to compensate. But over the past 2 years, over the past 2 decades, two things have happened. First, resistance has appeared to accelerate. And second, we really have no new drugs to respond to it. So the very, very serious resistance situation we've gotten into now, we really have almost no defenses against.
I want to get to the question of why we don't have new drugs. But first, gross us out a little bit. We hear about all these horrifying illnesses these days, MRSA, staph, resistant tuberculosis, flesh-eating bacteria. Which of these illnesses could actually be spreading in part because of this growing resistance?
Well, really all of them. That's the problem. So I'm looking at the WHO report from last week, and there are really high rates of resistance reported in incredibly common bacteria. For instance, E. coli. That's a bacterium that all of us walk around with all the time. It resides in the guts of every warm-blooded being and some cold-blooded beings as well. So when the bacteria in our guts that are there all the time develop resistance, that means that we're at risk at any point of that bacteria getting out of the gut and getting into our bloodstreams, getting into our kidneys, and causing really fatal infections. MRSA that you mentioned, that's drug-resistant staph, causes both really serious skin infections. It's well known in athletes. There are NFL and NBA players who have had to end their careers because of MRSA infections. But it also causes really rapidly moving pneumonias that can kill children. They're called necrotizing pneumonias. Their lungs just kind of melt. There's, you know, MDR-TB and XDR, extensively drug-resistant TB, that's moving across the world in travelers. There's things like NDM1, the superbug that was originally identified in India a couple of years ago that now has caused hospital outbreaks in the United States. The problem so much isn't which specific bacteria should we be most frightened of. It's more that the resistance problem has spread to so many families of bacteria that it's almost hard to know where to start.
So I don't want everybody listening to be so terrified that they think there's nothing we can do, because I think the CDC is trying to take some steps to roll back resistance. I'd like to bring another voice into the discussion. It's Dr. Michael Bell, who joins us now from Atlanta, and he is deputy director of healthcare quality promotion at the Centers for Disease Control. His division in particular works on the CDC's programs to prevent the development of antibiotic resistance. Dr. Bell, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Jessica. Good to be with you.
Hi. Okay, so give us some hope. What is the CDC doing to help ensure that this doesn't reach a crisis stage?
Well, so we are taking a very proactive stance at this point. I think it's clear that if we address the newer resistant organisms, the superbug that Marin just mentioned, in the same sort of relaxed way that staphylococcal resistance was addressed 20 years ago, it's going to become pervasive. And we are in a process right now of tracking down these organisms, finding them as soon as they appear, and then doing everything we can to contain and eradicate them on site.
Are you optimistic you'll be able to do that?
I think we can hold the line if we do things right. Really, it's a matter of timing. As you alluded to, there is the hope down the road for new antibiotics, and the country is certainly investing in that that important step. But it's going to be a few years, and so what we see ahead of us is a very important fight, trying to maintain the effectiveness of the antibiotics that we have and literally hold the line against this encroaching problem.
I want to get into the question of what this means for all of us at home and what it means for hospitals. But first, Marin, the White House is preparing a report on this topic. Do you have any idea what's going to be in it?
So a couple of weeks ago, the White House Council on Science and Technology gave a sort of teaser of what they were thinking about for that report. And what was really interesting was both how seriously they seemed to take the issue, as seriously as the CDC has and as the WHO did just last week, which is kind of unusual given that they haven't really made any pronouncements about this before. And the other was that they were clearly very interested in this problem of not having new drugs. Now, what's going on there is that if you think about making drugs just from a drug company's point of view, antibiotics aren't actually a good investment because resistance takes away their power very quickly, which means that people don't want to use them, and therefore you don't make back your R&D investment, and you don't make any money for your shareholders. So what people are talking about, including at the White House, is how to get drug companies back into the marketplace. What kind of incentives can they be offered to make antibiotics again, to make new antibiotics? And also an important part of that is, since they'd be brand new drugs, how to keep the price to the point where people would actually be able to use them. It's not yet clear what the best incentives are, but it's obviously a very active discussion.
It's interesting. I'm looking at some of the notes that our listeners on Facebook have written. Kyle says, what we need to do is tell physicians to stop ordering antibiotics like candy, stop prescribing them for sinus infections that are really just colds. Michael, is this something that the CDC is looking at, changing the way doctors are prescribing antibiotics, making recommendations on that front?
Absolutely. There is a concept called antibiotic stewardship. This is the concept of making sure that the antibiotics that we use are used for the right reasons and that there's an appropriate match between the thing that you're trying to treat and the drug that's being selected. We've found that when we look, as much as 50% or more of antibiotic prescriptions written in hospitals really could be better. Either they were used too long, or maybe there's not a perfect match between the bacteria that grew from the culture and the antibiotic that was maintained. So tightening that up, and by that I mean having people on staff whose job it is to look at the effectiveness and accuracy of antibiotic prescribing, having something systematic like an antibiotic timeout. And by that, I mean at day two, once your culture results are back, having a system where every antibiotic prescription pauses for just a moment to make sure that the match is as good as can be.
I just want to underscore that, Dr. Beld, for a moment, 50% of antibiotics prescribed could be better. Some of it even unnecessary, I take it.
Yes.
This is On Point. I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about superbugs and the growing threat of antibiotic resistance. And we're joined this hour by Maren McKenna, journalist and author who blogs for Wired at Superbug, also by Dr. Michael Bell, Deputy Director of Healthcare Quality Promotion at the Centers for Disease Control. And joining us now in studio is Dr. Stuart Levy. He has been one of the top voices warning of antibiotic resistance for decades now. He's a professor of molecular biology and microbiology at Tufts University, where he is also director of the Center for Adaption Genetics and Drug Resistance. He's also co-founder and president of the Alliance for the Prudent Use of Antibiotics and author of The Antibiotic Paradox, How Miracle Drugs Are Destroying the Miracle. Dr. Stuart Levy, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Jessica. Nice to be here.
So I want to just get a basic question explained. Can you explain how parasites, viruses, and bacteria all develop resistance, but bacteria poses the greatest threat?
Well, it's a question of what I call genetics. Bacteria have multiple ways in which they can develop resistance, one of which is to get some help from neighboring bacteria because their resistances are transferable, as if you could throw a football from one to another or trade cards. This is the unique feature, almost the science fiction feature of bacteria and their resistance. All bacteria and all microbes are going to be resisting. They're not sitting there waiting for other people to die. They're worried about themselves. So they're going to invent, as they have over the millennia, ways in which they can resist and survive. That's the principle for them. Think about it. What do they have to do? They're not setting up shop. They're not setting up house. They're living. They're doubling. They're taking their space. They don't want it taken. So this, I think, is a principle that has got not to be forgotten. And I think that it's also true that the world is now broad enough that when we think of resistance, we really have to think globally.
I wonder, you know, science has gotten us this far. If we're facing a new problem, can't science just resolve it? Can't we just develop new medications that will tweak the problem and end resistance?
It's not just finding new antibiotics, which we are all wanting and we need them, but it's also how we will use them and the ones that we have. And I think the antibiotic stewardship that was discussed earlier in the show is an excellent idea of what's unifying the groups that are looking at it. But we're talking about two different types of populations. Those populations which are in the industrial world where they have the money to be able to get the drugs and give them out and so forth. But there's a whole huge populations which do not have this sophistication or this money. So how do we join the developing world with the developed world in terms of antibiotics, which are needed for both?
It's a question a lot of people are actually writing in and calling about, and I'll get to those calls in just a moment. Maren, let me ask you first. You mentioned that some pharmaceutical companies haven't really been developing antibiotics at any kind of clip. Why would it not be in a pharmaceutical company's interest to develop the new medication? And what do you think? You said the White House might look at some of the incentives to promote it. What are some of those incentives?
So first, why wouldn't a company want to make antibiotics? Well, the commonly accepted numbers are that it takes about 10 years and up to $1 billion to make a new drug. So let's say that you're a company that puts in that effort and that money. You bring your drug out, and bacteria, as they will, begin to react to it, to evolve around it, as soon as you start putting it into patients. Go forward a couple of years, and possibly 20% of the bacteria that are being exposed to that drug are resistant to it. That's around the point where physicians start to say, maybe I don't want to give that drug to my patient. Maybe they're going to be one of the 1 in 5 who doesn't respond. So suddenly people don't want to use your drug as much anymore. Or conversely, if your drug is really good, maybe medicine says, this drug is so good that we have to keep it for the most serious patients. We have to make it a last resort drug. So we're not going to use it. We're going to put it on the shelf instead. Either way, fairly soon, that company doesn't make much money for its antibiotic and isn't making back that investment of time and money. So in a purely profit and loss sense, making antibiotics doesn't make anywhere near as much sense as making the kind of lifestyle drugs for cardiovascular disease or diabetes or obesity that people take all the time and will take not just for a couple of weeks to cure an infection, but for the rest of their lives.
All right. Maren McKenna joining us from Atlanta, Georgia. She is an author and blogger where she writes for Wired at Superbug. Maren, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We still have the two doctors with us, and so we can now get to some personal questions, I suppose. I think this is what a lot of people are wondering. Linda Hatfield Southern writes in, Dr. Levy, I'll ask you this. Is the answer to quit using antibacterial soaps and sprays? The scrubbing action of regular soap and cleansers works just fine. Do antibacterial soaps contribute to resistance?
Many of us believe they are, and we've gone to this to testing houses on whether or not their homes that are using these antibacterials have a different ecology, different groups of bacteria. We find that, interestingly enough, all the homes we studied, whether they were using or not using the antibacterials, had lots of resistant bacteria, indicating that it was happening while we were not even doing the study. I think that they contribute. I think that other misuses of antibiotics contribute. It's not just one factor, but the biggest factor for me in my experience is the misuse and overuse of the antibiotic itself.
Okay. So the other major factor is the use in agriculture. Antibiotics are used on the farm. And Dr. Bell, I was hoping you could explain why are antibiotics given to livestock. Why is that a bad thing? I would think, well, that means my food won't be diseased.
Right. So the use of antibiotics in food production really has three different categories. There's treating recognized infections, like we would recommend doing. Then there is preventing infections, where you give antibiotics even though there isn't an infection yet, hoping that you can prevent your flock or your herd from becoming ill. That's sort of shifting into the overuse realm, possibly. And then finally, there's growth promotion. We've known for a long time that if you feed a chicken antibiotics, it becomes a plumper, larger, marketable chicken sooner, which obviously is a good thing for the industry. All of that is relevant simply because of the scale of food production use in this country. There's a very large quantity overall of antibiotics that end up being used just because of the large number of animals in process. So there is the potential for huge impact. But I think the bottom line here is that all antibiotic use will ultimately drive resistance. So wherever it's happening, we need to be carefully considering how we use antibiotics. Hospitals hospitals, outpatients, food production, all of the above.
We'll take a call now. David is calling in from Dartmouth, Massachusetts, with a view on this issue. Hi, David.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. What's your question or comment?
My question is, it seems like there's a lot of blame going for humans' abuse of antibiotics, but obviously I'm more concerned about the agriculture. And looking at it globally, production seems to be growing in developing nations, and is their use of antibiotics going to speed it up more on a global viewpoint?
Thanks for calling, David. Dr. Levy, what's your answer
to that? It's a big issue, a very big issue, which has been one of my concerns for 30 years already. And finally, we're seeing some movement in the CDC and actually in the FDA on how these drugs are used in what's called growth promotion. Most of us now agree that the growth promotion use of the antibiotics is not needed, that the animals can be shown to grow if they're under hygienic conditions. Europe has banned that practice, so we believe that the U.S. is way behind. I think that it's a that 80% of all the antibiotics made in our country are being used in animals, and about 80% of that is going for growth promotion. So you do your math, you'll see that this doesn't make sense. I mean, these antibiotics are life-saving for people. So are they needed? Are they doing anything? Well, I think less and less they can be shown to be helpful, and more they're harmful because they select for these resistant bacteria, which then travel to our homes on the retail meats and so forth.
It's an astonishing statistic. 80% of antibiotics in this country go to agricultural use. I see comments here from Carrie saying we must limit the use of antibiotics in the meat industry. If factory farmed animals weren't crowded into filthy indoor confinement, antibiotics wouldn't be necessary to prevent disease. And if the meat industry didn't demand that factory farmed animals grow faster than the plants in your garden, antibiotics wouldn't be necessary to promote growth. Now, obviously, there's a counter to that position, and imagine it's coming from the farming industry, the agro industry. Dr. Bell, how strong is the lobby against limiting antibiotic use in agriculture?
You know, I really am not the expert on that, so I won't comment on the lobby side of things. But I do think it's a time when we can take a page from our European colleagues, and frankly, European culture that takes a very different approach to food. I am amazed at how much care and attention to the source of food is paid in many European countries. And I think America is gradually leaning in that direction.
Dr. Bell, can you tell us if someone wants to go out and buy antibiotic-free meat, if it says organic, if it says free range, does that mean it's antibiotic-free?
Not always. I think the labeling issue here is something that is still in evolution. I think that as consumer demand for antibiotic-free products increases, that labeling will get better and better.
All right. I think there's another area of focus here, which is the individual patient responsibility, Dr. Levy. I know personally, if I go to the doctor with a bad head cold and I don't get an antibiotic, I feel like the visit has been a failure almost. Is this something that's contributing to the problem? Is it generational?
It contributes enormously to the problem. And I think you're right in taking us back now to the people, because it's misuse of antibiotics in the hospitals and in the communities which leads to the resistant selection. What we don't have and what I think would help enormously is better diagnostics, so we actually know, is this a bacterial or a viral illness? Is it resistant or not? That's something that I think is moving, and we should see some inroads in that area.
Will you explain that? You mean when you go into the hospital, it takes a while for them to find out?
It takes 24 to 48 hours to know what you have, and it's even more important to know that, you know, this is a virus. Antibiotics don't work on viruses.
And sometimes while you're waiting the 48 hours, they'll give you an antibiotic.
You give the antibiotic while you're waiting, but then
it's not
when
necessary.
The patient, with the data come back and you see it and the patient's finally doing better and you're wondering, do you switch off the antibiotic? You should.
And that
but
doesn't
always happen.
Got it. Let's take a call from Randy. He's calling in from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Randy.
Hi, Jessica.
What's your comment or question? You practice medicine?
I practice medicine. I've practiced in the emergency department for more than 20 years. I've had a private practice. Within the realm of the emergency department, there's a major issue onto patient responsibility. They'll come in expecting antibiotics. If the physician in the ER does not give them antibiotics, then they will complain to the administration, who will then complain to the doctor and says, either make our clients happy or you're fired.
Wow.
In the private practice world, they'll come into the office and say, I've got a cold, I've got the sniffles, I've got whatever, looking for antibiotics. If you try to educate them and say this is probably viral, it's sinus infection, they will then go to some other physician and may not come back to your office. It becomes a business issue. There's patient responsibility that is very high up on the list.
Randy, thank you for calling. Dr. Bell, I'm guessing this isn't the first time you've heard about that kind of problem.
No, this is common behavior across the board. Parents with ill children want something for the kids. Again, in my own practice, I've had to resort to making care packages that were something that you could walk out of the office with to substitute for that antibiotic-driven concept of success.
That's smart. Even that, what's in your care package?
Well, so there are symptomatic treatments, cough suppressants, things to bring down a fever, soothing herb tea, whatever it takes, frankly, to make you more comfortable. This is something that is routine, again, in other parts of the world where people are a little less focused on coming home with an antibiotic. But they do think a lot about what's going to make me feel better while I get over this cold. So I also want to talk about sort of the extent to which this issue is going to be a game changer. When you talk about getting an antibiotic for something in an outpatient setting, you know, think about the fact that very common infections which do need antibiotics, like a bladder infection, right now can be treated with a prescription that you get filled, go back to work, and really your day isn't shot. On the other hand, if we're in a situation where these common antibiotics no longer work, every urinary tract infection with those bacteria that Marin mentioned that we all carry, if those are resistant, that could mean everyone has to go to the hospital for intravenous treatment at least for a couple, 3 days until we know for sure that they're safe. That kind of a change in practice is the sort of thing that we're looking at. In addition to untreatable infections, we're seeing a huge impact on how people live.
Dr. Levy, how does, for example, a parent know if they should demand antibiotics for their child?
I think the parents should be told that antibiotics should be given the same respect you give to your car. You are not going to change the motor. You're not going to fix the car. You're going to let a mechanic do it. So why are you prescribing the antibiotic? Why are you telling patients what I should give you? And why does the patient say, look, I'm here to get this fixed. I want an antibiotic. And I think that there's a difference in the culture in terms of what you want. In Europe, much more attention has gone to the misuse of antibiotics, and I think this is missing in our culture.
In just a few seconds also, can you tell us, what about in the work setting? If my doctor tells me, go back to work, you're fine, you're not getting an antibiotic, I should listen?
Yes. It's one word for all. It's yes.
But my colleagues don't want me sneezing all over them.
Well, I don't blame them either, but it's really a question of how bad it is. But
trust your
in
doc.
Most instances, most, this is going to be a viral infection.
I'm Jessica Yellen. This is On Point. We're talking superbugs and the growing threat of antibiotic resistance. We're joined this hour by Dr. Michael Bell, Deputy Director of Healthcare Quality Promotion at the Centers for Disease Control. And right here in the studio with me, Dr. Stuart Levy, Director of the Center for Adaption Genetics and Drug Resistance at Tufts. And he's also co-founder and president of the Alliance for the Prudent Use of Antibiotics. Gentlemen, let's go to a caller, Karen, calling from Columbia, South Carolina.
Hi there.
Hi.
This is me.
Hi, please. Hi, Karen. What's your question or comment?
My comment is that this is me. I had an infection caused apparently by a scratch from a hairbrush, and I became infected with a mildly resistant form of MRSA. Mm-hmm. I'm looking right now, as I speak to you, at my lab report. There were four antibiotics to which the infection was resistant, and fortunately there were seven that it was susceptible to. This, in another time in the past, it very likely could have killed me, but I'm fine. It went away. But I just wanted to make the point to your audience, but also to thank Dr. Bell and Dr. Levy for bringing this issue up. People do not have the basic scientific understanding to comprehend what you are telling them. That's unfortunate. There are lots of reasons for it. But I have had this conversation with people who simply don't understand what it is you're saying. And I realized I had to talk on maybe a third or fourth grade level. People don't know what a bacteria is in terms of its difference from a virus. They literally don't understand that. Fortunately, this experience has made it possible for me to kind of lay it out to people. But people don't understand that, and they are obsessed. Many people are simply obsessed with the idea that antibacterial soaps, hand sanitizers, all of this is their protection. They don't understand the concept of mutation. And what is resistance? They don't understand it. I so much appreciate what all of your guests have said, but honestly, people do not have the basic science to understand what you're trying to communicate.
Karen, thank you so much for the call, and I'm so glad that you're healthy again, but it's a shame you had to go through this. Dr. Levy, let me put it to you. You are president of an organization dedicated to the prudent use of antibiotics. I assume you're trying to educate the public. How do you break it down for people who still don't understand what we're talking about? What is the central message you'd like to get out?
The message simply is that antibiotics work against bacteria, but not viruses. I mean, that's one concept that should be understood. So if you have a viral cold, an antibiotic won't help. And what will happen is you will transform the environment in which your sick patient is found and make it resistant to all these different antibiotics. So there's a double-edged sword here. I think that we at the Alliance and also at the Center in Boston are geared to deliver messages to the public at large. I wrote a book. I think we know that this is a need. And what's shocking to me is after all the education we think we're getting across in media and so forth, this idea that antibiotics work on viruses is still around. And I agree with the caller. It's shocking. We should somehow do better. And that's something we're fighting, but it's very hard when many people have grown up in the idea that there's a pill for every ill, and whether it's viral or not.
Dr. Bell, is part of this the authority and the reverence in which we hold doctors, that if a doctor does prescribe us an antibiotic, we assume it's essential and we have to take it and we shouldn't question them at all, and that sometimes you should, in fact, ask your doctor if this is necessary?
Well, I'm a major proponent of asking lots of questions of your doctor. I think it's interesting that we trust them to say we should take something. We apparently don't trust them when they say we don't need something.
Exactly.
Which is classic, you know, human nature. Uh-huh. I think the key here is conversation and being willing to listen. And I completely recognize that when you have a screaming child with a sore ear, you know, sometimes it feels like the brass ring is that magic antibiotic. But having the conversation and listening and making the backup plan, saying, all right, well, I'll tell you what, we'll go home now with the comfort care stuff. But if there's any change in this, you know, what are the three things that should make me come back to you that would mean that maybe I do need an antibiotic? That kind of conversation can help.
Let's go to Morris, who's calling from San Antonio, Texas. And I think, Morris, you might have some ideas about other solutions we could be looking to.
Correct. Hi, Jessica.
Hi.
Hi, Dr. Bell, Dr. Levy. I've met with Dr. Bell. He was nice enough to host us at the CDC in Atlanta. And I can tell you that the CDC is laser focused on these issues. And he's certainly extremely knowledgeable. We make a germ zapping robot. This is in about 200 hospitals around the country. In Boston, for example, Beth Israel, Cambridge, Mass General, Nationwide, Stanford, UCLA, 24 VA hospitals, MD Anderson. And you know, you can't keep creating new antibiotics, right? That's not going to work. There's not the economics don't work right now. So therefore, antimicrobial stewardship, which is only using the antibiotics when they're absolutely necessary, is the first step. The second step is we have proven in the hospitals that if you take a robot that's the light coming out of it is 25,000 times brighter than a fluorescent bulb, we can eliminate the pathogens that cause the infections. That includes MERS, it includes the viruses, it includes the spores, so that then the patients don't get sick once they're in the hospital. So this idea that you could go to the hospital and get sick, that doesn't have to be the case anymore. And using a germ zapping robot is an extremely effective way to stop the spread of those bacteria, viruses, and spores.
All right, Morris, thanks for that. Dr. Bell, I think I want a germ zapping robot. Is this the answer?
It's one of several answers. I think it's great to bring up the issue of the environment, whether it's the tabletop next to your bed or the surfaces in the bathroom. The world is covered in bacteria and viruses, and it's just the way things are. We can help by reducing the amount of bacteria on surfaces, whether it's with a robot that zaps with light. There are companies that also make a fogging device, or just good old-fashioned cleaning. You know, there's always the challenge of making sure these strategies are used correctly. But if they are used correctly, we can reduce the ability of the environment to act as a way station for these resistant germs, so that there's less likelihood that someone will touch that surface and then deliver that bad germ to where it doesn't belong.
Awareness of our environment and possibly new robots to help us keep them clean. I think that sounds otherworldly. I want to go to Craig, who's calling from Cedar Rapids, Iowa, with his comment. Hi, Craig.
Hi, Jessica. I'm 70 years old, and about 10 years ago, I started taking oil of oregano periodically during the day. I haven't had a cold or the flu for going on 9 years, and it's just I'm into other natural therapies too. There's a hospital in Cedar Rapids that has started a holistic department with documented therapies. The staff was so excited, they stood up and cheered and clapped because it gave them another tool to help their patients.
Craig, sounds great. I'm glad you're well. Thanks for the call, Dr. Bell. We just heard about a futuristic answer, a germ-zapping robot, and then other people are looking to go back to our origins, simple natural remedies. Could that be part of should that be a piece of our solution? Let me put it to you, Dr. Levy.
I think it should be, and I think that any practice or any new ideas that are not harmful, try them. And I think it may not be the process itself, but the idea that you are now have a mindset to deal with this in a more holistic way. And so that improves the situation. We won't know whether it's the thing you do or the fact that you have decided to do it that makes a difference in terms of an effect on the infection.
Well, what are you looking at as alternatives to antibiotics in the future?
We're looking at the stewardship, looking at how antibiotics are being provided. What is the basis of choosing an antibiotic? Get to the individual patient or the individual community member. We know that there are bacteria out there in the environment. And in fact, some of the work that we're doing is to identify the kinds of bacteria that are out there that we brush against all the time. In fact, in India, when they had this NDM1 bacterium, which was resistant to the last generation cephalosporins, I think that we were able to see that this was a route to identify what might be coming down the road by knowing what's out in the environment itself.
I've also read, Dr. Levy, about healthy bacteria that doctors are now trying to put in the gut to repair troubled guts. Is that a replacement for antibiotics?
In fact, it's some places routine after prostate surgery or after surgery in the bowel to replace the bacteria that are there with a more grouping of bacteria, sort of as a probiotic. And I think that all of these ideas do two things. One, they offer a possibility, but more importantly, they set the stage of belief and action of the patient to take care of him or herself.
So in other words, you're saying empower yourself
exactly.
to find solutions
exactly.
before turning to antibiotics. So I got to ask, how about probiotics, eating yogurt? Is that helpful?
I think, as I've said, I think that in some instances, there are actually studies that show it works. In some instances, they don't show that it harms. And the patients are all saying, this is great. So I like the non-dangerous methods that bring the patient to really thinking through, do I need an antibiotic or not?
Dr. Bell, one of the challenges is tracking where these resistant bugs are spreading and when they're coming. I wonder if technology has been helpful on this front or could be. A company like, let's just say, for example, Google would start seeing people putting in questions about similar symptoms in certain regions and probably know when an illness is moving through an area. Can you guys harness that kind of information to respond?
Well, I think that's a great idea. And we harness a wide variety of information. So we are, for one thing, pushing out technology to detect these organisms so that people can actually test for them. That's a major important step. I think Dr. Levy also mentioned the importance of diagnostics. The other thing that we're doing is collecting isolates so that we can understand what the type of resistance actually is and share that with people who need to be developing new drugs. So there's that relationship. There's a major initiative on bioinformatics. That's the computerized analysis of microbiology that CDC has invested heavily in the past few years. And it's showing us that the organisms in the gut that we thought we knew, we actually probably don't know about 90% of them. And when we talk about probiotics, there's the yogurt approach, which is what we've done to date. It's one or two organisms. But we might actually be looking at a future when we know that a cocktail of organisms, maybe a dozen, two or three dozen organisms, is really what we need to establish a healthy framework in the gut.
Let's go to a call. Mary is calling from Shirley, Massachusetts. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Jessica. How are you?
I'm well. What's your comment?
I just have two quick comments. First of all, I got MRSA or exposed to it in 2000 from a car accident. I was in the hospital. And obviously, 14 years later, I'm just fairly careful with people coming into my house. Because I get, as you guys know, I get really sick when I get sick. And so the second comment I have is that as I'm in a wheelchair, so I always test positive for a UTI. And working with the doctors over the years, we have decided that unless I'm symptomatic, I am not treated. And I think that's really important for people to know. Don't run to the doctors because you don't feel well. And I see that all the time, and it's frustrating. And that's how I'm bringing up my family. I just wanted to make two small comments on that. But I really appreciate your show.
All right, Mary, thanks for the call. She's more cautious than some people, Dr. Levy. We've all seen, we can't say we've all, but many of us have seen the movies that trace out what the worst case scenario is, outbreak, where there's some sort of bug spreading across the world and we have no means of treating it. How close are we to letting that become a reality?
Well, I think the report that came out from WHO is an example of the fact that we are getting closer and closer to that situation because it's anywhere in the world. So we're not talking about something that emerges only in the United States. It could emerge in Southeast Asia and come to the U.S., as we've seen with MERS, this new virus that's out. So I think that we can't talk about that as if it's not possible. We can talk about it as a future, but I think we can try to prevent such a happening by, one, knowing what the resistance is in bacteria all over the world through WHO and even U.S. and European activities. And so we can prevent the spread and we can control. But bacteria will be around. They've seen dinosaurs come and go. They're not going to leave the world because we so directed. So we have to play careful and we have to not waste these drugs because they're not easy to come by, as we're seeing now.
And Dr. Bell, give us some hope. What's the rosy scenario? How can we look to a future where we have this under control?
Well, you know, before I get to the rosy future, I just have to share with you the fact that when we talk about antibiotic resistance, when we talk about losing antibiotics, it's not just about those untreated and untreatable infections. And we have seen those where there's absolutely nothing we can do. Antibiotics are the safety net that lets us give cancer care. Without that, we can't help people with cancer. Burn patients, even trauma surgery, relies on the presence of antibiotics to allow that to happen. So the stewardship that Dr. Levy's mentioned is very important here. And preventing infections in general is a major initiative that we're focusing on.
Dr. Bell, thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Bell, he is Deputy Director of Healthcare Quality Promotion at the Centers for Disease Control. And Dr. Levy, thank you for being here. Dr. Stuart Levy is Director of the Center for Adaptation Genetics and Drug Resistance at Tufts and co-founder and president of the Alliance for the Prudent Use of Antibiotics. You can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Coming up tomorrow, we'll be covering the botched execution in Oklahoma, which the president has called deeply troubling. I'm Jessica Yellen in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.